There is no single way to read well, though there is a prime reason why we should read. We read not only because we cannot know enough people, but because friendship is so vulnerable, so likely to diminish or disappear, overcome by space, time, imperfect sympathies, and all the sorrows of familial and passional life. The words of Harold Bloom there from the introduction to his book How to Read and Why, first published in 2000. Bloom, one of the most original, influential and controversial literary critics of the past five decades, has written extensively on Shakespeare, Yeats, Joyce, Beckett and the 26 writers he chose to represent the Western canon of literature in his celebrated book The Western Canon. Bloom is credited with the concept of the anxiety of influence, the book of the same title from 1973, creating its own anxieties, oppositions and influences ever since. As a critic and writer on literature, religion and poetry, Harold Bloom has never been afraid of controversy, speaking his mind on political correctness, feminist and Marxist theories and the many isms of postmodern critical thought. His forthright expression of his opinion has not always endeared him to fellow academics or to some writers. Now in his early 80s, Harold Bloom continues to write and to teach at Yale University. We visited him recently at his home in New Haven. In person, he's charming, bossy, warm, endearing. Graduate students come and go. The phone keeps ringing.
Oh, excuse me. I will get rid of this very quickly, okay. Son. Dear Vincent, oh, it's Angus, the best critic in North America.
I've had.
Magnificent Angus Fletcher, I am sitting here being introduced, being interviewed, and we are talking about Yeats at the moment. Do you have thoughts about Yeats you wish to impart? This is the author of many great books.
I suppose we could quote him, Horsemen Pass By.
Yes, but I don't like that poem, Angus, dear. That's the elegy for himself.
Yes, it is. Sure.
Irish whiskey is welcomed and enjoyed. Everyone is called dear or child, even me. And the keen, open, searching mind is constantly at work. Harold Bloom, can we talk a little about poetry as a kind of pulse in your life? Seamus Heaney has said very simply and wisely, poetry helps us live.
A lovely man, Seamus. I have not seen him or his beautiful wife in some years now. I remember reviewing him very early on in the Times Literary Supplement. What was the volume called? Was it Fieldwork? It was Fieldwork. And saying this was someone who could not miss. I'd followed the previous books, but I thought that was a kind of breakthrough for him. But he's a stunning poet. I think the three poets alive now in the English language, not necessarily in that order of eminence, but of almost equal evidence, are Seamus, that dour and remarkable man, Mr. Geoffrey Hill, and my close friend John Ashbery, whose new volume has just come out and with whom I had a lovely phone conversation yesterday. But those, I would think, are without match at this time.
What has poetry meant to you in your life? I think you fell in love with it when you were a young boy.
I first started to read Yiddish poetry when I was 6 and 7 years old. I didn't know any English yet, even though I'd been born and raised in the East Bronx in New York City in the early 1930s. I first fell in love with the poetry of the remarkable modern Yiddish poet Moshe Leib Halpern and some of the others like Yaakov Glotstein and so on. And I think the first poet in English after I taught myself to read English, whom I really came to care for, was in fact Shakespeare, but I'm not sure I had any clear notion of what it was that I was reading when I read Hamlet or Macbeth in those days when I was 9 or 10 years old. But then when I was 10 or 11, I discovered Hart Crane in the Melrose branch of the Bronx Public Library and fell in love with his poetry, though I certainly had no way of understanding it. That high invocatory strain captured me and swept me in, even though the complexities of the syntax and the exalted nature of the vision were really beyond me. I always quote, probably I overquoted, the other great modern American poet. Well, there are also, of course, Mr. Frost, and if you like him, the abominable Eliot, and a few others like Marianne Moore and my old friend Elizabeth Bishop, now long gone. But there's a wonderful sentence of Wallace Stevens in prose. Poetry is one of the enlargements of life. It's a very carefully weighted sentence. He's not saying it's the ultimate enlargement of life or the only enlargement of life, but it is one of the enlargements. I think I'm willing to go by that. Though he doesn't, of course, mean enlargement in the sense of taking a photograph and enlarging it. He means something rather more inward, I would trust.
A kind of illumination of life.
Yes, a kind of illumination.
Baraka is a sometimes controversial figure. His poem, Somebody Blew Up America, written in the wake of the attacks of 9/11, led to accusations of anti-Semitism and the abolition of position of Poet Laureate of New Jersey, which he'd held. Later in the programme, we'll hear some of his memories of the civil rights struggle of the 1960s and his take on the state of America on the eve of the presidential election. But first, I've been talking to him about music, jazz in particular. What has jazz meant to him over the years?
I began listening to what they call the old doo-wop, the rhythm and blues people. But my cousin, my first cousin, came home from World War II, and his brother gave me all his bebop records, you know, the old Dials and Roos records. And for the first time then, I heard people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Monk. And from that period, when I was about 12, 13 years old, I became very devout in, you know, listening to what was then called bebop or modern jazz, you know.
Does jazz and its cadences influence the way you write, you know, your own rhythms and the sounds you seek to make?
Well, yeah, because not only because I listened to it all my life, but a lot of times I'm playing the music when I'm writing, not intentionally, sometimes intentionally, but simply because that's the way, you know, my study is organized, so I can play the music when I want to. So, I'm hearing the music, and if I think of something I want to write particularly, there's always that kind of added, rhythmic impulse. But it's generally because the music permeates my whole kind of being by now, you know. I'd studied the blues for a couple of years, particularly because a professor I had in college took me to his house and actually showed me all of his blues records and jazz records. And he said to me, he played the music, he said, that's your history. And it took me a while to understand that. A professor named Sterling Brown, who was a great poet, he said, that's your history. And what he meant is that if you listen to that music closely, you'll find the history of Afro-American people. And of course, he was very true. Even today, the so-called rappers, the hip-hop people, they're still talking about their lives, whether they're real or fictitious. You know, you can still trace, time, place, condition, those things. So it's been a constant with me for a long time.
I know that you're reading some of your poems in Galway at this Jazz Day, and we'd love to hear some of your work. Maybe you'd read one of the poems for us.
Okay. This is from a book called Wise, Wise, Wise. It's Y apostrophe S, W-Y, W-H-Y apostrophe S, W-I-S-E. And I got that from James Baldwin. He said, if you ask why enough time, you'll be wise. You'll have a lot of whys. This is a poem from that book, the first poem, the introductory poem, really. I need a drum. I'm going to make it with the top of this table. I hope it doesn't disturb it. Africa. Africa. Go back, Black. See yourself. World, 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 see yourself, touch yourself, know yourself. Africa. Mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa. Creator of the human being, of music, of dance, of the city. Mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa. But when you put your hand on your sister, made her a slave. Watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa. Ghost gonna get you. When you put your hand on your brother, made him a slave. Watch out, Africa. Ghost gonna get you. Ah! How'd I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and the water blowing through my ears? How'd I get here on my back in the dark? My brother the king. My brother the king sold me to the ghosts. Obatala Shango, save me, save me. Obatala Shango. How did I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and the water blowing through my ears? My brother the king sold me to the ghosts. Obatala Shango, save me. Wade in the water.
So in a quite genuine way, I heard about these things from my mother's knee, you know, from growing up. So when I came to try and paint something that would represent violence and the ambiguity of violence, I chose Kelly.
The late Sidney Nolan there in an interview with Liam Nolan from 1973. And 20 years after Sidney Nolan's death, a significant collection of 26 of his Ned Kelly paintings are on loan to the Irish Museum of Modern Art at Kilmainham in Dublin. We're going to visit that exhibition with Hamish Maxwell-Stewart, whom you've heard earlier, visiting professor at UCD and from the University of Tasmania, and Dr. Yvonne Scott, head of art history at Trinity College Dublin. First, Rachel Thomas, head of exhibitions at IMA, on this visiting exhibition from the National Gallery of Australia.
We have been in talks with them for the last couple of years, actually, in securing this, because they don't come like an ordinary, like one aeroplane over. We had to do separate consignments. It's almost like they're such a national treasure that we had to actually organise two separate plane journeys, separate crating, because they are a kind of treasure in Australia. So it was negotiations, talks, raising funding for this. And then what we wanted to do is combine it with our own works in the collection.
And of course, it's really significant that as well as the Ned Kelly paintings, there are some of the paintings that Nolan made here and donated to IMA, the Wild Geese paintings from 1989.
That's right. We have six of them on display in the basement here in the museum. These were donated to the museum, and we're delighted to show them because actually it has a nice juxtaposition with the early works of Ned Kelly, the infamous bushranger, and then we have the later works of the collection owns by Sidney Nolan, which shows more abstract brushstroke, greater uses of colour, and more freedom of expression, whereas the Nolan pieces are very tightly condensed, humorous, funny, and then we have the later works, which are more poetic, more influenced by James Joyce, have more a meditative meaning on reflection, and also then you can kind of compare the two. So it's almost nice to show a whole sweeping history of Sidney Nolan.
Yvonne Scott, we're standing in front of this extraordinary Sidney Nolan landscape, Australia, glowing out of it, and the desert and the blue sky, and Ned Kelly on horseback. It is an amazing painting.
It really is. I think what makes this particularly interesting painting is the way he's composed it, where he's got the figure of Ned Kelly right in the very centre, giving this vertical break in the painting, and then you've got this horizontal edge of the horizon cutting across in the other direction and completely breaking the traditional rules of how landscape should be composed. And he's given us Ned Kelly's a very authoritative figure. We see him from behind the back of the horse and looking out on the landscape. And you notice the way with the armour, he has given you a view through into the sky through that the slot, you know, through which Ned Kelly can view from his armour. Almost as if we are Ned Kelly. That's the view that Kelly had, and that's the view that we have of the landscape. And I think one of the really interesting things about this painting as well is how he's represented the landscape, completely broken with the traditional way that landscape would be represented, because he gives us just this line in the distance with a scrubby line of trees. There's no destination in this landscape. There's no protection from the elements in this landscape. And you feel very, very exposed, in a sense.
And just thinking, again, it's three elements in the figure. You know, this horse, man, and musket. and man is almost anonymous because the slit in the armor, in the headpiece of the armor, is blank. You see the sky through it, and it is an amazing image.
Yes, it certainly is. And the way he's represented the figure, and this is how Kelly is represented in all of the paintings. It's this flat black silhouette. We don't see any details. We don't see any characteristics. And this has become really an iconic symbol. This is what we recognize in every Ned Kelly landscape we see, or a picture of Ned Kelly in the landscape, is this black figure. I think it's interesting to think about the materials that he was using, because again, he was using non-traditional materials. He wasn't using oil. He was using commercial paints. He had trained in design and craft rather than in fine art, and so he's using materials that really challenge the painting traditions of the establishment.
When were the paintings made?
These were painted in the 1940s, in the mid-40s, not that very long after the end of the war. And one of the things I think is interesting to consider is how young he was. He was under 30. He was born in 1917, so he was under 30 when he painted these. And it's said that he identified with the Kelly character himself. Sidney Nolan had been called up into the army in 1942, and in 44 went AWOL. So he was a rule breaker, if you like. And what I suppose what's interesting with this idea that he identifies with Kelly is that one of the reasons why he decided to go AWOL was he said that, you know, he had no intention of carrying a gun or shooting at anyone, which is almost the reverse of Ned Kelly's situation. But at any rate, he took an assumed name and disappeared. We don't know where.
Became a rebel with a paintbrush.
Exactly.
It's almost a little surreal to be here, Edna, because years ago I used to look at your photograph, one of those famous portraits in Kenny's bookshop on Shop Street, close to here, sadly gone now. And I was thinking about that and thinking, I'm sure you walked these streets many times, Galway being a kind of capital of the West.
Well, yes. I was in a convent in Galway where I didn't walk the streets. I walked the grounds of the Convent of Mercy. As a young person and as an old person, I love Galway. I always thought of Galway when we were growing up. I thought of it as being, which it is, very, very alive. It's so vibrant, this city, in every sense. You hear music. You hear music nearby and you hear music far away. But Mrs. Kenny, the older Mrs. Kenny, mother of Des and his brothers, two tiny stories, because they're connected with Galway, I'll tell you about her. One was that she claims that as a young girl of 16 or 17, I came to Galway and I was taking the boat over to Arran because I worship J.M. Singh. And, you know, when you're young and trying to write, or even when you're not young and trying to write, you feel if you're in the habitation of a great writer, something might happen, some of the magic. It's wishful thinking. But I was going over to Arran. I went into Kenny's bookshop, either en route there or coming back. And there were photographs of many authors on the walls. And Mrs. Kenny claimed that I said, I don't quite believe it, because I was a bit, not timid, but definitely. She said that I said, I'll be there one day. So that was one little story. But the other was, we jump cut, and Mrs. Kenny was an extremely religious woman, and a lovely woman, but she was religious. So I wrote a novel, Down by the River, which was loosely triggered by the unfortunate and ex-case altered to the country and that. So it was a book that really didn't belong to the sodalities as such. And I come into Kenny's shop where Mrs. Kenny is now older and she's sitting behind a big thing like that, lectern. And I think, what is she going to say to me? And this is what she said. She came out, she put her arms around me and she said, well, if someone had to do it, it was better it was you. It's a wonderful She let me off the hook. But I do love this city. There's a great heart in it still. And in the world at large, both in people and in cities, and indeed in landscape, there is less and less heart to be seen, to be found.